Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, Internet? It's sometime during the holidays, and you're listening to Waypoint Radio. I'm your host, Rob Zachney, and I'm joined by Gita Jackson.
Hello, I'm Gita.
And our producer, Ricardo Contreras.
Hello.
And we are going to be talking about Aaron Sorkin's Magical Autumn. This fall, Aaron Sorkin returned to the cultural news, at least, with two things that released, I think, within a few weeks of each other. The first was a Get Out the Vote special that he and the cast of The West Wing put on in advance of the election. The When We All Vote West Wing special, where they did a live reading of Hartsfield's Landing, an episode from The West Wing that takes place as the first votes are being cast in a primary in New Hampshire. Then he also released a movie for Netflix called The Trial of the Chicago Seven. And that is about, well, I mean, it's about the title. Yeah. But Gita, you want to give the précis, the setup for Trial of the Chicago Seven?
It's about the trial of Abbie Hoffman and some other less well-known leftist activists for inciting a riot at the 1967 Chicago Democratic Convention, where it was widely known as being an absolute circus that lasted for months based on trumped-up charges completely made up by the government. Aaron Sorkin has an interpretation of those events.
Yeah. I think, you know, Gita, I think the last time we talked about Aaron Sorkin, we were talking about his To Kill a Mockingbird productions. And I think we both had a feeling that this is a guy who, on one level, senses times have changed, that like the politics have shifted and that some of his assumptions about how the world worked have since been disproven since he started his very long career in writing these very civic-minded works of entertainment. And yet, he's also Aaron Sorkin, and to a degree, he's a middle-aged boomer who can, or at least Xer, who can only change his spots so much, still like will return to like center-left modes of thought. And I think, in light of that arc and where he's at in his relationship to contemporary politics, both of these things become interesting for different reasons. West Wing is probably the apogee of his political worldview. It is about like how awesome was the Clinton administration, how awesome is progressive neoliberalism. The good times will never end. And Trial of the Chicago Seven is very much about trying to find justice in a increasingly authoritarian state and the tension between radical politics and progressive institutionalist politics.
But you see, Aaron Sorkin is also a messy bitch who lives for drama, who can't help but put his own personal beefs into all of the work that he's ever done. The particular episode of The West Wing that they do in the live special doesn't feature this necessarily. It is actually a very well-written episode, one of my favorite episodes of the series, and it was very interesting to see it with the older versions of the cast, especially Dule Hill. But in other aspects, there's a whole episode where Aaron Sorkin just calls out fan fiction writers And that's just like the whole episode of the show. And it's very weird. It's bad whenever any television show or movie does this. Don't do it. It makes everybody feel fucking weird. And like a lot of the trial, the Chicago 7 has a lot of very complicated issues that we will get into in depth, I promise you. But for a large part of this movie, for at least the first two thirds, are a weird little movie about wanting Chapo Trap House to call you cool. That's just like he hates podcasters and he casts certain figures, certain historical figures in that movie as leftist podcasters. And that is really what the movie is about.
Interesting point.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the special real quick, because this was something I was fully prepared to dunk on. And here's the problem. I loved The West Wing growing up. I might still love The West Wing. I understand all the reasons it's bad, but I was watching this thing and I was like, uh-oh, I am feeling a connection to this thing. This thing is resonating in a way I was not fully expecting it to work. I think it helps that it's a pretty cool thing they did. They shot an episode of The West Wing with the actors reprising their roles in a theater with very stripped down sets. And it is on one level just kind of a cool experience seeing all these actors, including the bit players who are on The West Wing, reprising their roles. Like you will recognize reporters from the pool. You know, they return to be reporters in this production. It's neat seeing these characters again. It's also for me, like a thing that really struck me is how good this cast is at playing these characters.
Even after not seeing them for many years, I haven't watched The West Wing since I lived in Chicago. So it's at least 3 years for me. And this is after really it being a comfort show for quite a long time. Seeing this cast of characters back together, the chemistry is immediate. They slip back into these characters like absolutely no time has passed. Even when it's weird that like Dulé Hill is so much older and no longer convincingly an aide, like it still feels like you still understand the sort of natural positions that all these characters are in. It definitely makes the way that he gets hazed and then weirdly hazes CJ Craig in this episode feel slightly more problematic. But that is likely one of the only complaints I have. I mean, I skipped all the celebrity confessionals about how good it is to vote because I was watching this many months ago when I was trying to write something and I considered rewatching it. And I was just sort of like, I don't know if I can survive seeing Michelle Obama on my screen.
So that wasn't great. I will say, the bit with Lin-Manuel Miranda is very funny because it is basically,
that was funny, yes.
Yeah, it's basically like, hey, dude, we find you annoying. Like, you're overexposed and tedious at this point. Shut the fuck up. And that is the bit where he's like, I thought you guys wanted me to just read the fucking text, Lin. And he's like, okay, so I... And he started reading the text, and it's all basically subtweeting the cultural institution that he has become. That stuff was kind of cool. It was wild to see Elizabeth Moss, showing up. She's like, me and Dolly were the youngest members of the cast, so we've been picked to talk to the young voters, which makes no sense, but here we go. Yep. That stuff was great. I think it is, Gideon, you mentioned the chemistry, and I agree. It's kind of startling how perfectly these actors can fall back into the pattern of a Sorkin script and the give and take they have during a scene with their fellow cast members. It's just like, I always figure at a certain point, you just fall out of practice with a character. And it is weird to see 20 years can go by. And it's like these characters have been raised from the dead. It's like seeing people you haven't seen in ages exist. Like it's
uncanny is what it feels like to me. Like it's I think this is why a large part of why Aaron Sorkin has deluded himself into thinking his style of screenwriting is applicable to any situation at any time is that he wrote a drama series about The West Wing in the style of a screwball comedy, and all of these actors just knocked it out of the park. But it's because they're very talented actors who clearly fit in very, very well with each other. I feel like part of Sorkin's like issue is that he does not acknowledge that film is like a collaborative process, that it is not just one. There's no one person who is responsible for what you see on screen. It is dozens of decisions being made by dozens of different people. some of them very, very minor, but they all end up creating this thing, this art object that you see. And Sorkin is so just high on his own supply, huffed his own farts on the idea of auteur theory, that he can't, like, hear when you see him work with actors that he really know his work and really like his work and really believe in his work, you see why we all thought it was the best shit ever for so long. Removed from that, as we can see in Chicago 7, there's like a lot of just weird significant issues. There's stuff where if I looked at this script, I probably, were I editing it, cut half the dialogue. You know, like I would just have said that there's no way anyone's going to talk this fast and have it be understandable. But especially seeing it as a staged play where you are not, you don't have the luxury of looking at everyone in full costume or on a full set, the sort of lavish West Wing set they had that felt very familiar by the end. You know, the way they have to do a walk and talk is they have little lights on the stage to indicate that this is a hallway, which I thought was very funny. But it's, you can see how much work the actors are putting into this. And you really understand. So if I want to understand West Wing as a show, if I want to understand why everyone loved Judd Bartlett, we have to understand that these are some actors who interpreted Sorkin's text and added value to it.
I think to a degree, like the misogyny, the casual misogyny of Sorkin's work, I think was obscured by how good Allison Janney in particular was at being C.J. Craig, where like she was hilarious. She played these bits off incredibly well, but also it was usually about like, hey, you know, C.J.'s kind of the dummy of the group, even though she's also the hyper competent. She's also kind of the dummy.
And well, she always, and in this episode, she makes someone look stupid for not following procedure, which is something I would do. Absolutely. If I worked in somewhere as important as the White House and I was press secretary. If you take out classified documents and I don't know where they are, that's fucked up. I'm going to make you look dumb in front of people. You deserve to look dumb. But then she gets her comeuppance for being so uppity and forward. Yeah. And like that is the thing that is obscured by how funny Allison Janney is and how she can play that as a joke that she is laughing with at the very least. But here, seeing it again as an older person, I'm just like, why? She was just right. She was, he fucked up. he just fucked up.
Speaking of characters, so the other place, she was just right. Ditto, Donna, whose part in this episode, so Hartsfield's Landing is this tiny little town in New Hampshire that votes early, and just due to a quirk of fate, they always predict the eventual election of winner of the general election. So it's an open primary, I guess. And, you know, whoever they vote for ends up being president. So Josh has gotten obsessed with this and wants to win Hartsfield's Landing. And his solution for doing that is to have his assistant, Donna, call this family that has defected. They were Bartlett voters. They're Bartlett volunteers. And now they've gone over and they're supporting the Republican candidate, Governor Ritchie. And Donna calls them up to figure out what's going on here. And there's a point where she comes back inside. And this is Josh and Donna to a T is uncomfortable emotional intimacy that either needs to be addressed or like closed up in a box. Like it doesn't work. And that is a huge problem throughout the West Wing. But the other part of it is Donna is often the voice of the everyman Rube, who just don't get the politics, doesn't understand policy. And that happens here where she starts trying to tell Josh, why has this group of blue-collar folks in New Hampshire defected from the Bartlett Coalition? Why are they contemplating voting for the Republican? And the joke, I think, in the scene to an extent is that Josh has this command of these issues and knows Bartlett is good, knows the policies are good, and every time he's trying to lay this out and explain why they're doing what they're doing, he's met with just sort of a dumb response of like, but I just want stuff. I just want a job. I just want things to be good. And it's all through the voice of Donna, who points out like, no, they're pissed about salmon fishing. Why are they pissed about salmon fishing? There's no salmon fishing in New Hampshire. Well, yeah, but this guy Mackey, Flinders has a has a cousin in Oregon who has lost their job because the canning factory shut down. And he's pissed because free trade meant the local paper mill or something has gone under, and there's tons of jobs have just drained out of that community. And and Josh is responding with, no, we're for free trade. It makes, like, free trade makes people richer. It makes the economy better. We've dedicated money to trade, to job retraining. I don't understand, like why are they coming at us with this stuff? And in the context of 2020, you watch the scene, and it's like you can hear the ice cracking under the feet of the Democratic mm-hmm. coalition. Mm-hmm. These pointed, very simple questions that Donna are asking, Josh has these complicated answers for, but the issues are not, they are simple issues. Tons of people in my community had jobs they no longer do because the jobs have gone mm-hmm. abroad. What are you going to do about it? Well, job retraining. Okay, but for what? There's nothing in the area. What do you want me to do? This notion of, why do they care about people in Oregon? Because people have families and they have connections to other communities that they also care about. And so, like, this entire scene.
You might say that Josh Lyman is not very conscious of class. It's like he accidentally wrote, like, why libs are bad at class consciousness, but he didn't realize that he wrote it. It's frustrating. Sorry, go ahead, Rob.
No, sorry. Sorry if my reaction seemed off. Skype, Discord glitched at that point, so I didn't hear what you said. But I was basically wrapped up there. But basically, like, that scene, I think there are tons of scenes like that in the West Wing where it's like, here's a simple rubes approach to politics, and why doesn't this highly competent technocratic administration have answers for these questions? It's because these oversimplifications are dumb and they don't want to engage with them. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you have to, though. Like, to a degree, people do not care how complicated. It's that internet hippo, I think, tweet where it's like, you know, the problems are bad, but the causes are very good.
Very good. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. This is the same position the West Wing takes on the idea of protest, right? If you were really dedicated to social change, and this is relevant for Chicago 7 as well, if you're really dedicated to social change, you would get into politics, you get into government, you try to change the system. There's no question of whether or not the system itself is the thing that is corrupt. Whether the system is savable, that's an accepted position by everyone on this show already. I mean, it's not surprising because they do work in, you know, the federal government. I'm not surprised that people would take this, but there's no interrogation from anyone else of that viewpoint. That viewpoint is always unilaterally accepted as correct.
The other thing running through this episode, and I think it's related to this tension, is so there's a great scene where Toby and Bartlett are playing chess. And this is a follow-on from an earlier episode where Toby went in on Bartlett and basically argued that Bartlett is making cowardly decisions because Bartlett still has issues about how his relationship with his dad. This is classic, like, in Sorkin world, it all comes back to, like, trauma around your dad frequently. And it just gets writ large. But in this season of The West Wing, I remembered so much of it hinged on Toby trying to convince Bartlett, hey, man, just show everyone how smart you are. Just be a badass and, like, show what a true intellectual titan, you know, could do for this country. Except that's not how Toby began, and I think it's not how he ends in The West Wing. Toby begins as kind of a New Deal Democrat in a lot of ways and is less concerned with, like, yes, he is an intellectual and values that stuff, but at the same time, he's also somebody who's like, no, we need to be providing more direct aid to people. The government needs to be doing more things to make people's lives better. And as the series goes along, Toby starts becoming yet another sock puppet to just be like, no, like, these technocrats are good and they're smart and people should shut the fuck up and listen to them. And so the episode kind of culminates in him basically, like, he draws up the game plan for Bartlett's reelection, which is Bartlett's going to be real smart and people are going to love that. And I'm like, and to a degree, oh, that was kind of Obama. People did like it because Obama was clearly hyper competent and also incredibly articulate and charming, had incredible political instincts that I don't think translated to a political theory. But you look at it and it's like, I think he might need to be able to speak to the people who just want fucking jobs, though. And
yeah, I think that speech felt very pointed, just given what election it was just before. You know, the specifically Toby saying, make this about qualified and not, you know, intelligent and not, which is essentially the campaign strategy that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris settled on, was this idea that Trump is incompetent, true, and that they are competent, debatable. So it felt, you know, the thing about that, though, is like, we don't have a philosopher king like Barack Obama anymore. And a lot of people who voted for him, a lot of people in my specific generation for whom voting for Barack Obama was their first presidential election, they have fallen out of love with his ideologies. So you see this and you're like, I know that it's going to work just because, like, Barack Obama did get elected, Joe Biden did win, but I don't know if that is really, those are really the allegiances that people had, if that was really the thing that they were voting on. You know, a lot of the time it's lesser of two evils. The idea of hope after, you know, 8 years of war, just a fucking endless forever war, horrible economy, bad jobs, that was a potent, pointedly political position to take at the time. And it was something that people really needed to feel out of despair. That wasn't about qualified and not. That was about, we want to have jobs again or not.
Yeah, to a degree, I think his intellectual prowess helped him win the Democratic primary. I think the fact that he wasn't implicated in the Iraq war is like ultimately what undoes Clinton. Like if she had not done that, she would have been president. The other thing, though, is I think his ability to deftly handle the racial politics of his moment. And like in particular, I'm thinking back to as there was increasing focus on the rhetoric of Obama's former reverend, Jeremiah Wright. Mm-hmm. And he sort of had to sort of distance himself between more black liberationist movements and his own ideology before he totally cut ties with Wright. He gave some really remarkable, insightful speeches about like race in America that I think really resonated powerfully with people, in part because it was exactly the kind of things that like made liberals comfortable and feel good about the direction of the country. But I think you're right. When it came to the general, like he was the guy who was like, hey, I did not burn down the economy and I'm here to help and you're going to get health care. And people were like, fuck yes. And then the reality was, but not good health care. And I'm going to, you know, you'll come second behind the banks, behind the investor class. Then we'll see what aid is left in the cupboard.
Not too much. Guantanamo Bay is still open.
Yeah, so like I think it was a cool special. It was also fascinating to see now in stark relief just how ideological the show was. And I don't think it knew it was ideological. Like I think genuinely it thinks these sort of technocratic solutions are just good sense solutions. They're not coming from a place of ideology. They're just coming from a pure place of pragmatism. But if you stop and think about for just even a second, the notion that the best response to somebody who has lost their job, as well as all their neighbors have lost their jobs, the notion being, well, you know, maybe you should get job retraining. That should be, you know, in order to live, you should be required to go back to school at age 35, 40, 50 and get a new set of skills and start over. You, like, that's ideological as fuck. And yet somehow in the West Wing verse, it's like, that's just common sense.
It's just plain old common sense.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think this is one of the best West Wing episodes, but it also showcases all of the limitations of the West Wing as a show.
Yep.
All of those limitations fall squarely on the shoulders of Aaron Sorkin.
Last thing I'll say, just this is also not purely a Sorkin joint, as it were. Thomas Schlamm directed this. He stage directed this. So his old collaborator is there in the credits, I think, as the guy who is like helping stage direct. And I've always sort of had the suspicion that as long as Schlamm was around, for the most part, like Sorkin's worst successes tended to be curbed. And then from there, it totally depends on if he has a strong collaborator that he's working with.
Fincher was perfect for him, I think, with The Social Network. Fincher is a lot like Rick Start Removing Ruben, you know, where he strips things down. He stripped everything down from that script. And, like, he found a way to pacify Aaron Sorkin for when he was getting mad, too. He was like, okay, here's a lens. Go do some B-team shoots over there if you want to be a director so bad, you fucking idiot. Did you not know, if you watch the, there's a featurette I own the DVD for Social Network, which a movie I think is brilliant. I think it's very good.
Wait, he literally tells it like, hey kid, go play with this camera.
Seriously. He's like, and Sorkin talks about it like it was like a reward he was getting. So Fincher obviously clearly knows how to talk to little babies too. Little whiny babies.
That is so funny.
He was like, Jesus. Yeah, I was on the set so much making so many suggestions. Eventually Aaron Sorkin, you know, he let me set up some shots.
That's incredible.
That's amazing.
And he used those skills for the trial of the Chicago 7. Gid, I was sort of DMing with you throughout this.
Sorry, we should just cut to break here. This is probably a good time for a break.
Sure.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
And we're back?
Yes.
So
last night, one Robert Zachney started DMing me while I was having my own Joker-fying experience watching the Game Awards. And Robert Zachney, the wise Robert Zachney, had an emotional arc with the movie The Trial of the Chicago 7 that was identical to the one I experienced.
So Gina, you had said weeks ago that, like, yo, this is not very good. This is kind of a mess. And I was like, yeah, but, you know, like, sometimes Sorkin makes messy shit that's kind of fun.
Yeah.
And at the start, for the first 20 minutes, I was like, where's the mess? I love it. Yeah. Like, it's very silly.
It's like snorting a rail of pure Sorkin right in the beginning.
Yeah. It's a rail. And that is just a pixie stick, by the way. It's just like,
not very hard shit at all.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I was like, this is cool. So the setup for this, and Gita, you can then correct what is being portrayed in the movie with what, like, is actually the state of play here.
There's so much shit that absolutely changes the ways that he talks about the events of the movie that he just fucking made up, completely changed people's personalities. But I will point them out as we go on.
So at the start of the movie, though, the setup is we see all these different activists from all over the leftist movements of the 60s. It's like early summer 68. They're all headed out to Chicago to go protest the Vietnam War at the convention. We see there's like the yippies who were like sort of these super nonconformist hippie groups. We have more respectable, just like pacifist anti-war groups. We have
groups, generally speaking, yes.
We have Bobby Seale, who's sort of representing like black nationalist groups and the Black Panthers. But he's heading to Chicago for his own protests. We see like more, I guess we'd say like respectable or centrist like anti-war groups representing more like the Kennedy wing of the party. Showing up to protest the Vietnam War. And they all head off. And then we get a cut to they're all in fucking jail and they're on trial. And we do not actually see what went down in Chicago. We just see them all going off and being warned.
What you're describing now feels just like an Always Sunny episode. The gang gets arrested.
The gang goes to a protest. So the next thing we see is they're all in jail. And they're on trial. The intermediate step is they somehow get arrested. We see John Mitchell briefing two prosecutors for the newly elected Richard Nixon, being like, fuck these guys up, like throw the maximum book at them and send these guys to jail forever and just show like there's a new sheriff in town. Right. Like the Nixon administration is not going to accept this shit the way the liberals did. And one of these lawyers is Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who is clearly sort of a like very Kennedy-esque new frontiersman. He's got the little horn-rimmed glasses, et cetera. He's very clean cut. And he's like, oh, I'm uncomfortable with this, but I guess I better go do this prosecution. And then we see the trial, which is just already like basically done as a who's on first like sketch comedy bit. Like you have this complete mismatch, almost like it's a bit like the Muppets in some ways, the way this cast of characters, like all the
Muppet-esque, for sure.
Yeah. All the protesters don't get along in really interesting and funny ways. You have Frank Langella putting in great work as Judge Julius Hoffman, who a guy who is clearly a piece of shit, but also very confused about what is happening and is just not up for this and is completely baffled.
A Diane Feinstein type, you might say.
Yeah. And so the first 20 minutes are like just kind of fun chaos with a lot of Sorkin-esque repartee.
It's good courtroom drama stuff. Like the actual trial is like a totally bonkers, totally like months-long trial that was completely acknowledged at the time as being a complete media circus and just a circus itself, an absolute farce. It went on for months. They brought in like Joan Baez and like a live pig at some point.
So if anything is weirder than what we see here.
The trial was much weirder than what was seen here. I know you mentioned later in the movie, when we were DMing last night, later in the movie, Abbie Hoffman and what's his name? That is his friend. The other yippie. Yeah,
his buddy.
Abbie Hoffman and his friend. They show up to the courtroom in judge's robes. And it's treated as like this incredible comedy bit. They did not, like the pig that they brought to the courtroom was their nominee for president, Pigasus. So I don't know why you would do the courtroom thing, like the judge outfit thing, which is like minorly funny, and not the pig running for president thing, which is incredibly funny and also more indicative of their political positions. But that's just a minor quibble I have.
Yeah, and so the other dynamic here is that, first of all, like Bobby Seale is being denied representation, and he's been tossed into the middle of this trial where he was not even at the protest where all hell broke loose. And he is being advised by Fred Hampton, who's sort of giving him tips on like how to navigate the situation. We get Mark Rylance is playing William Kunstler, who's kind of the old shit-kicking activist lawyer who's trying to corral all this into a coherent legal defense.
He's great.
Oh, he's so good. Like, I think he and Langella, like, make this thing work because so much of it depends on them both being funny and also being completely believable as guys dealing with the situation for real.
Yeah. Yeah, but once you move on from, so the setup to the movie essentially casts these groups of characters as representatives of ideologies, which makes it easier to forgive the way that they deviate from history, because what essentially Sorkin is doing is trying to get a bunch of different leftist ideologies in a room and have them argue with each other. That I'm absolutely signed up for. That sounded good. And for the 20 minutes, this movie is that. Then once you start to dig deeper, you realize that it's not leftist ideologies that are all arguing. It's Aaron Sorkin arguing with everyone who's on the left that is not exactly him. There's a scene early on when we're starting to get to the meat of people's ideological differences with each other. The character that's played by, I was hoping you'd say his name because I forgot, Eddie Redmayne's character.
Oh, Tom Hayden.
So Tom Hayden is the only person that Aaron Sorkin consulted
with on
this script.
That is wild and explains a lot about this movie.
Yeah. It explains, like, once you learn more about Tom Hayden, I'll get into that in a second, might explain a little bit less about the movie. Okay. But from the perspective, the way that Tom Hayden is portrayed, it explains a lot in this movie. But Aaron Sorkin is the only consulted with Tom Hayden, who is portrayed in the movie as a spineless lib, essentially. And it doesn't make any sense, like, that is true, because Bobby Seale wrote his own script about his own experiences during this trial, which are harrowing, and has been trying to sell it to different studios for many, many years, and no one's picked up. So,
huh?
Yeah.
Well, and Sark's not going to, because those aren't his words, and you must love the playwright, the scribe, the bard.
So, in the scene where the movie for me absolutely started to fall apart, Abbie Hoffman, who's played by Sacha Baron Cohen, trying desperately to do a Chicago accent and not really making it out.
I was texting you, I said, I think he ended up at Elliot Gould. Like, yes, genuinely, like, right. Elliot Gould in The Long Goodbye, I think, is who he ends up turning into.
Yeah,
which is, like, I'm just a cool counterculture rebel who, like, yeah. I mean, he might as well have had a martini glass in literally every scene.
I mean, the portrayal of the yuppies in this movie is absolutely ridiculous. The yuppies were the first irony bros, which is true. Like, they levitated the Pentagon. Their disdain for mainstream culture did present itself as sort of a detached remove, where the things they did to make their political statements, they were funny, but they were also cruel mockeries of a system they didn't believe in. Abbie Hoffman was the de facto leader of that group, and the way they portray activist leaders in this group, in this movie, is so weird. In the beginning scene where everyone's presenting their ideologies, so the students are in a classroom and they're giving a speech. That makes sense. You know, Bobby Seale is leaving to go to Chicago, but he stopped in at a Black Panther headquarters before he goes, where people are trying to dissuade him from going. That makes sense, right? Those are activities those two people would do.
But also to give him guns, right? Yeah. Just because Black Panther is just like, we're all about arming our people. So naturally, you should just go and here's a 38, brandish it in front of the police and see what happens.
So the yuppies, what they do in that scene is like, they're at a bar doing stand up. Just doing stand up. Like, that's what he thinks that leftists do when they get together. Like, they just go to a bar with a stage and get some people on stage to tell jokes. Like, that's it. It's very weird. It's very, very, very weird. These people were serious political organizers. And if you've ever been in a room with serious political organizers, yeah, there will be jokes told, but it isn't a performance. That it is about a community. So there's a scene where Tom Hayden, who has been presented as a very clean-cut gentleman, very white bread, he's Eddie Redmayne, right? Like, he's his cheekbones and all that shit, is scoffing as Abbie Hoffman says this trial could possibly lead to a cultural revolution in terms of how we think about the Iraq War because of all the media attention, their viewpoints are getting out there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Tom Hayden says, I don't like cultural revolutions because it gets in the way of real revolution, which brings us back to this idea Sorkin has that the system is fine. It's the actors that are bad, which we now know very definitively is not true. The system is fucked. It's completely fucked.
And it's not just the actors who are bad, but also the people who are really wrong are the people who are calling out the system as being fucked and are proposing like radical institution demolishing solutions where he's like, no, man, if it weren't for you guys, we'd be able to fix these things. But you guys don't actually see what the real problems are. You're just like, in so many words, you're virtue signaling. I'm here wanting to actually fix the problems, which coincidentally corresponds to I will advance considerably professionally and amass a considerable amount of power in these institutions, and then I'll fix them.
So the thing about Tom Hayden, though, like, I told my dad about this. My parents haven't seen the movie. I told them it would probably frustrate them, and I don't know if they're going to watch it. But my dad participated in the civil rights movement in Selma, Alabama. And as he got older and went to schools in the University of California system, he became interested and, you know, a supporter of the students' rights movement. And essentially, you know, is contemporary with a lot of the figures that are on trial here. He remembers the trial, you know, it was happened during his time. And he told me that he knows, and I looked it up afterward, Tom Hayden is much, much more radical. In fact, kind of a weirdo. In fact, one of the quotes on his Wikipedia page is about how he is so happy that his son married a non-white person because he's hoping for the slow and peaceful dissolution of the white race.
So he's bought into the Bulworth philosophy political change.
He was married to Hanoi Jane. He was married to Jane Fonda. Like, he was a radical.
Jesus.
He was a radical, radical. And he is portrayed in this movie as the exact opposite of Abbie Hoffman when they have a ton in common. This fact just makes the whole movie fall apart. Like, you know, like it feels like a real weird fucking shame.
Real quick, because you mentioned it, the Hanoi Jane thing. For people who are not familiar with weird, I don't know, that slur isn't quite the right way to describe the way Jane Fonda was treated, but Jane Fonda had all the makings of like a generational star in Hollywood, like Hollywood royalty, like incredibly talented, good looking, had it all, got involved in leftist politics, visited North Vietnam as part of protest to the Vietnam War. And from that point forward, just became known as Hanoi Jane. And like, you will still hear people of a certain generation be like, oh, I don't like Hanoi Jane. Because like this, in some ways, I think She's one of those early figures who gets caught up in the right-wing smear machine where somebody makes an obviously good and valid point. And instead of engaging with any of that, they just get kind of dismissed with this shit. And yeah, the more you learn about Jane Fonda, she rules.
Every nasty nickname that Trump has given any of his political enemies is born out of the phrase Hanoi Jane.
Yeah. So the other part of this, so there's two things I think that happen. One is that Bobby Seale is eventually dropped from the trial, and then kind of from the story. And it kind of feels like there's two things that happen in really quick succession. It accounts for this huge tonal shift in the movie. And you know things are about to get real because Abbie Hoffman is doing his comedy set. He's sort of the chorus, doing a stand-up bit, narrating the action. And
obviously never happened. And the actor that is playing Bobby Seale, just want to really shout that out. He's the same actor that played Dr. Manhattan in The Watchmen show. And he's just absolutely amazing. He's amazing in the scene. Everything that happened in that scene, the way that he is bound and gagged by the judge who is sick of hearing him talk, essentially, just sick of hearing him speak, that is all true. And the thing that makes it weird, though, is that this is not the emotional climax of the film.
No. And we get Abbie Hoffman being like, I need a minute before I tell you what happens next in the middle of his comedy set. And everyone like starts getting the news. And the news is, of course, that Fred Hampton was murdered by the Chicago police. And that sets up this final confrontation with Bobby Seale, who continues to basically no longer comply with the trial in any way, shape, or form, because what is happening is unconstitutional. He has no representation, and he is bound and gagged. And at that point, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character is like, "Hey, I can't be a part of this. This is illegal, and we got to give this guy a mistrial." And so he is dropped from the Chicago 7 slate of defendants and sort of exits the plot after this final showdown in the court, which is a pretty harrowing scene. But it also sets up what the movie is actually interested in. This fucking blew my mind. Sorkin, I kind of wondered, why haven't we seen any of the protests? Part of me was like, well, Sorkin's a stage guy. He probably doesn't, he's not comfortable with action. We know this. That's never been his take. I can imagine he's kind of hesitant to shoot that stuff. But like, it was weird. Why haven't we seen any of it? And the answer is because Sorkin thinks the way to do this is to make it a mystery. What actually happened the night they were arrested? And so we start piecing together the events of what happened in Chicago, and there's a lot of the early clashes with police. We see how the protest movement was infiltrated by informants, et cetera, et cetera.
But I've got to point out really, really quickly, the subplot with Ruben sleeping with an FBI informant never happened. Never happened. Just smeared his character posthumously for no reason. But anyway.
Yeah. So then we get to the trial is beginning to go sort of well for them. They discover that Michael Keaton was the former attorney general of the U.S. And he had it's true. Look it up. Michael Keaton was the AG. No, Michael Keaton is playing Ramsey Clark, who was Johnson's AG. And he basically reveals that the Justice Department looked at these protests and decided not to prosecute anybody because their conclusion after investigating what happened at the DNC in 68 was that the Chicago police had lost their shit and had just assaulted protesters for days. And no crimes have been committed except those by the police. So they just ignored the entire thing. And so he testifies to this, and it reveals this entire trial is a bit of a sham, and they're beginning to, even though Hoffman is running this rigged trial, it's beginning to get some traction. And then Gita, I swear to God, this is where I lose my mind. Their defense attorney, Kunstler, he finds a recording of the night that they all got arrested, and Tom Hayden was making a speech. And it turns out that Tom Hayden said something like, if blood is going to flow, let it flow all over the streets of Chicago. And it's kind of his like, oh shit, they got you, son. That's an incitement to violence. You were inciting. And it's sort of the shocking, and this is a Sorkin thing to do. It's always like, what did the person do wrong to get the institution to turn against them? This shows up in fucking everything. Early episode of The West Wing, CCH Pounder's character is called on the carpet because she calls a Republican. A Republican congressman asks, are you calling me a racist? And she's HUD secretary. And she says, well, if the shoe fits. And they're like, damn, how dare she do that? Doesn't she know she's going to be smarter than that? This happens across Sorkin's work. And here it is again. What did the person confronting this obviously unjust system do wrong? And in this case, it was Tom Hayden said, let blood flow all over the streets of Chicago. And we get a flashback to that night. But then, and it's like, how could you do this to us, Tom? You fucked it up. You blew it, son. And then Tom Hayden says, our blood. Gita, do you want to explain why this is significant and how this transforms the conversation?
So, Abbie Hoffman from here. God. This is the point in the movie where I started becoming the Joker. Like, this is where it truly began for me. I was already, like, bored and confused by this point, and, like, just kind of watching out of sheer momentum, like, wanting to know how they finished it. But here where I was like, oh, this movie is, like, a hateful little piece of shit. Fuck this. Where Abbie Hoffman starts saying how he's read all of Tom Hayden's stuff, and he often uses vague pronouns when he's, you know, try or leaves out pronouns. He references a specific technical part of speech in a very Aaron Sorkin way, in a way that Abbie Hoffman never, ever, ever would have talked about anything at all. It's not that he was unintelligent. I mean, most of these people began their journeys as leftists on college campuses and either stayed and graduated or dropped out. But he starts, it essentially becomes a scene where you can tell what Aaron Sorkin wants is for a figure like Abbie Hoffman, a figure of the disenchanted youth, the irony poisoned left, to tell him that actually he's cool. Like, you start to understand as Abbie Hoffman is being effusively complimentary towards Tom Hayden and forgiving him for the mistake of using vague pronouns to accidentally and unintentionally incite violence, you realize that this is what he wishes podcasters would be saying to him and about him, about his work. All that he wants in the world is for Will Menaker to say that Aaron Sorkin is a cool guy. But, and you can tell also that he wants it to be judged on a very specific kind of merit, very specific kind of like technical and creative merit, where it's like the eloquence of the Hayden's speeches are the things that are celebrated here in this scene. And it's just like, number one, it's the scene where everyone becomes a mouthpiece for Aaron Sorkin. Everyone from this moment on just becomes Aaron Sorkin's mouthpiece. It's obnoxious. And two, it's just like, I don't believe now that you actually understand the historical significance of this event. And you've just absolutely just completely misrepresented a lot of history, a lot of important history.
Yeah, it's an astonishing decision, in part because it's like this reflex to invent a mystery that can be revealed and solved over the course of the trial. Again, like that's a sturdy plot concept, but this is just not what happened. Like, there is no, the modifier wouldn't have made any difference. Like, they still would have said, like, well, you said let our blood spill, so obviously we're still implying, like, let there be confrontation. Like, it just doesn't matter. And this is how rhetoric works. Like, slip of the tongue somehow explains, like, this is how we got on the hook for this, and this is what you meant, and that was good protesting, but you slipped up and you did bad protesting.
The cops were looking for someone to blame. The fucking, like, Richard Nixon, you know, Nixon?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Nixon administration specifically, like in the beginning of the movie, they actually say to us, the audience, that the Nixon administration is looking for someone to blame. So you can't retroactively blame Tom Hayden and then be like, oh, but it's okay because Abbie Hoffman thinks he's cool. It's like, no, Tom Hayden did nothing wrong. None of those people did anything wrong. They showed up to a protest and are brutally beaten by the cops. That's it. The end.
Yeah. And so we move on from there. And then we're just like, well, then they get convicted. Okay, they, like, literally, you see them. Next, you see they're not in their clothes because they were bailed out. They are in prison jumpsuits because they've been convicted, which we don't see, and now they're getting sentenced.
Really sad that we missed out on a scene of whatever celebrity actor that we got to play Joan Baez showing up, because they also, they put essentially the trial in the intervening months that they don't show became the thing that Abbie Hoffman described. It was like they stopped really participating or engaging with the system itself and started bringing in celebrity leftist guests to explain leftist ideology because they knew that the trial was being reported on every single day.
So we don't get any of that. Instead, we got a little bit of sketch comedy from Abbie Hoffman. I will say I don't hate Baron Cohen's performance. Like, he's fine. But
he's fine, but compared to Vincent D'Onofrio in the Abbie Hoffman biopic.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Night and day. Yeah. I saw that as a child, and it clearly imprinted on it. So
yeah.
It's quite good, I would say. Yeah. It's been a while. I mean, I was like 16 when I last saw it, so maybe it's quite good.
Yeah. Good caveat, though. Like, oh. Yeah. Look, as a teenager, I loved it. Look, as a teenager, I loved The West Wing. And I still do on some levels, but now my love has changed because I'm older. But yeah, so then the movie turns into Dead Poets Society. I'm not even kidding. It turns into Dead Poets Society and it fucks me up. Langella turns to Tom Hayden, who now we know is a good leftist because, like, Abbie Hoffman gave him that bro fist. And is like, I think you're an incredible patriot, Tom. It's like, that's beautiful, man. That's beautiful. And so Hoffman is like, you know, you're the only one who's respected these proceedings and respected this trial, respected me. And so if you're allowed to make a remark, but if you keep them brief and apologetic, that will be taken into account for your sentencing. And Tom is like, okay, so all I got to do is be brief and conciliatory and apologetic and respectful, and you'll go easy. And Hoffman's like, yes. And then Tom Hayden just starts reading the names of people who have been killed in Vietnam since the trial began. 4,000 names. He starts reading through them all. And we get the, like, you know, the classic Langella's up there being apoplectic. I've lost control of the situation. And everyone starts coming to their feet to stand respectfully and cheering as he names.
It's a circular pan throughout the room. So you get a brief close-up on this whole crowd's face as they, like a wave, just begin to stand up in the crowd and literally do a slow clap.
And then not only is the crowd full of the supporters for the Trial 7 moved by this, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character stands up respectfully and stands to attention. And his buddy, his corrupt Justice Department shithead, is like, why are you standing? And Gordon-Levitt turns to me. He's like, respect for the fallen. And
the real message of the Chicago 7, you got to respect the troops, baby.
Yeah. Respect for the troops. Saves the day. The next thing we find out. So we fade out on like this moment where everyone's like, damn, we just love the troops. We hate the war, but we just love those troops so much. Let's show respect. This is not who you thought the left was. The left loves America. The left loves the troops. And the next thing we find out is all these guys were basically let out on appeal. Like they were convicted, they were sentenced. And then because the trial was such a sham, the Circuit Court of Appeals threw their case out and was like, this conviction doesn't hold. They'd have to be retried. And the Justice Department was like, we can't go through this again. We're done. And they drop all charges. But the implication is, because Tom Hayden has this like notebook full of troops' names, and this moment is so powerful that like this is kind of what kind of saves the day. And that's how the movie ends.
So I want to tell you one really important thing. There were more than one closing statement. And one of them was done by the pacifist that in the movie where
Dellinger.
The old school pacifist, the conscientious objector. Who they portray as breaking his vow of nonviolence by punching a cop out of frustration, which is very frustrating because that character specifically chose to become a conscientious objector and a pacifist because of a fight he got into in college where he punched someone and became very uncomfortable with his ability to commit violence.
I just want to call it that guy is played by John Carroll Lynch, who I think plays the guy, the Zodiac killer in Zodiac.
Yeah.
But he's a character actor you've seen in a million things, and he's just a pro and he does it well here. He's great.
Very, I mean, it's a shame they kind of they removed him from the movie using that event that didn't even fucking happen and like is completely antithetical to who that person was. But he gave a statement calling out the unjustness of the war and the system that they were being forced to be in. Like, it's absurd how by excising particular facts completely changes the events of this trial to conform with Aaron Sorkin's political beliefs. But the people who are portrayed in this movie did not believe the things that he says they believe, and the public and like reaction to this trial was not the way that he portrays it to be. Like, everybody, while it was happening, even before these statements, they were all kind of like, man, it's fucking weird that a bunch of these people are on trial. It seems like a totally trumped up charge based on nothing. And the fact that it took months only cemented that in people's minds. That scene with the conservatives and the right before they get in the courthouse, like the most hackneyed scene in the whole thing, where it's conservatives on one side and libs on the other, and they're chanting, and they have signs, and they have signs that are say, boo, Chicago 7, or yay, Chicago 7. But they're all chanting, all of them, in unison, the whole world is watching. Like, did they get together and decide that?
See, everyone's watching, and they see the same reality. Yeah.
It wasn't that the whole world was watching. It was that the government was trying to pin the blame on a riot on a bunch of people who were very obviously not there and unrelated. And a lot of people across political spectrums could see that truth. And people only thought it was more unjust the longer the trial went on. And it went on for a very long time.
You point something else out there that I think is, like, literally this movie does not give you any sense of the scale of the assaults on protesters that happened at the Chicago Democratic Convention. You just like, you think the movie would lead you to believe that the whole thing happened at this one protest that these characters were at where all hell broke loose. But these characters never get anywhere near until the very end. They never get anywhere near the convention. And like, one of the things that made the convention such a circus is like, there were just nights of police just beating the shit out of people in the streets of Chicago. And you would leave this movie thinking all the violence that happened centered around these guys' protests. And that's what this hinges on. And not that these guys were scapegoats for what was described by the Justice Department, I think, as like a police riot. So yeah, it's a messy movie. And I think it is, I think you're dead on that. This is Sorkin, as he has tried increasingly to try to sort of like reckon with the failures of his more conciliatory center left politics, he tries to give a bit more of a hearing to the radical left. But even there, he can't quite do it because he doesn't really understand them. And his mode of understanding them is to turn them into yet more Sorkin sock puppets who like care about where you went to college and care about shit like sentence structure and not like the content of your political theory.
You can't convince me that Abbie Hoffman was out here doing fucking sentence diagram on Tom Hayden's speeches. Like, those guys linked up because they both opposed, like, American political hegemony and the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And, like, it also frames the leftist position against the Vietnam War as being specifically and only about American casualties. Abbie Hoffman and his associated collaborators objected strongly to our culture of imperialism. They objected strongly to the murder of Koreans and Vietnamese. They objected strongly to war as a construct. It wasn't just about their friends dying, although the draft had a huge part of it, and the draft was a huge part of why the rest of America eventually became, you know, largely in opposition to the Iraq. I keep almost saying Iraq, but half of, you know, 7-1-6, you know, half a dozen, six of the other. I'm so tired. whatever that phrase is.
No, but I do think, like, Tom Hayden gives one answer where he was like, you didn't enlist. And he was like, yes, I declined to go kill people in Vietnam. That's the closest we get to him objecting morally to what is being done to other people in other places by the U.S. war machine. But beyond that, you're right. It entirely centers on U.S. casualties. And I think a big part of that is, because the Sorkin worldview and the strain of progressive politics he represents turned out to be very cool with endlessly waging war in other people's countries. And you to pull that off, to explain, like, and I think it's a revealing choice, and I think maybe in some ways it is accurate to, like, explain what happened to a lot of the anti-war movement as those people grew up and aged. But yes, the protests against Vietnam were about what was being done in Vietnam to Vietnam. And the way it is often remembered is as a protest against the draft, being compelled to serve, and possibly be killed in a war. But, you know, in terms of, well, the war we wage, like how we wage it, that stuff is fine. It's just you shouldn't make people go do it against their will.
Yeah, Agent Orange was always like a huge part of these conversations. You know, right. Chemical warfare was always a huge part of these conversations, right? These were the things that also these activists specifically objected to. They were right. not shy about it either, you know?
And,
like,
and these just critiques. Think
about Muhammad Ali saying, like, I don't have any beef with the Viet Cong. Like, that yeah. was part of the argument that they're making, that there was no reason for Americans to be there. There was no moral reason for us, a more moral justification for us to be committing violence on this scale.
And this ends up being the more trenchant critique as technology has changed. Like, the reason we shouldn't be at war at war all the time is not because, you know, we talk about Americans coming home in body hit bags, and the toll of war is real and terrible. And there's a lot of people who are not killed in combat in U.S. service who also become grievously wounded and affected throughout their lives by that experience. It's true. But the real, like, one of the real arguments against waging these types of war is just it is immoral to unleash this kind of destruction and terror against other people in other places who are just trying to live their lives in peace. And if your objection to that is, well, you shouldn't send people who are drafted to do it, then that is an immoral argument.
Well, that's how drone strikes become morally yeah. acceptable.
Right.
You know?
Well, we didn't risk any American troops.
Yeah.
And the people
we
were killed.
We killed a whole wedding party, but we didn't risk any American
troops. They were other. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think we'll leave it there. I think the movie is... it's entertaining as an artifact of Sorkinism and a portrayal of his reaction to this moment and his attempt to reckon with these politics, but also reveals his incapacity to reckon with these politics.
His time has long since passed, you know? Like, yeah. he is no longer a political thinker that we need to pay any attention to, and this movie proves it.
Yeah, his best work has secretly been kind of about office politics and the way, like, people yeah. in institutions address each other.
The Social Network is a great movie about office politics and, like, some really interesting business journalism.
Yeah.
You know? And Moneyball, very similar.
Sports Night, like, entirely about, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, go watch that stuff. If you do want to see Chicago 7, you know, it's on Netflix.
Turn into the Joker.
Yeah, just you know what you're getting into. but we will leave it there. We will be back with another episode of Holiday Fun at some point soon. I don't know how this is all coming out. But anyway, you can follow me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. You can follow Gita where?
At XOXO Gossip Gita.
Kato. Kato, you can find it at @A_Kato_appears.
I took a bite at the bat. Sorry.
I realized you were eating, and I was like, I'll just cover. Like, this poor man is so hungry. He yearns for food. And thank God there's one podcast we can just munch through while Gita and I will just chat. Kato, I hope you enjoyed lunch.
Thank you.
The theme music is by Too Mellow. We'll be back with more Waypoint Radio holiday specials. Until then, fuck capitalism, go home.